Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's called Trappist One, and while it has nothing to do with 17th century monks, it does have astronomers feeling divinely inspired. Trappist One is the solar system unveiled last month that contains seven planets, three of which scientists say could possibly support life. The discovery, first reported in the journal Nature, has set the astronomy community on fire, wanting answers to many more questions. Do these three planets have atmospheres? Do they have water? And how warm might they be, given that their sun is only classified as an ultra-cool dwarf star? We're heading out into space today in the Exchange, figuratively, of course, with our sky guys as co-pilots. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, especially if you want to get your questions in now about this TRAPPIST-1 solar system that has captured the attention of so many. Our sky guys are Mal Cameron, former astronomy and space educator at the McCullough-Shepard Discovery Center. And Mal, it's always good to see you. Welcome back.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Also with us, John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. And John, welcome back. Great to see you, too.
Great to be here also.
Well, Mal, I'll start with you. It's hard to overstate how excited scientists were about this TRAPPIST-1 announcement. What's so cool about this, Mal? We've detected planets outside our solar system before.
Yes, we have. And in this case, this is the first time we found seven planets all orbiting the star that are roughly the size of Earth. And that's pretty exciting because, of course, we're always hoping that it's somewhere along the line we're going to find a planetary system with an Earth-type planet and with liquid water on it. And out of these seven, there are at least three of these planets that are in what's called the Goldilocks zone around the star that it's orbiting. The star is called TRAPPIST-1, by the way, and it's not like our sun at all. So we can't really compare it to us. It's a red dwarf star, which is very small. And the best analogy, size-wise, you can think of is that if you made our sun the size of a basketball, this star would be roughly the size of a golf ball.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's a good analogy.
It's quite small. And in order to get heat from that star, you have to be very close to it, which these planets are. All seven of them zip around that star like crazy. In fact, the one that's closest to it, which is called TRAPPIST-1b, the star is always the A when they do this. So B is so close that it only takes a day and a half of our time to make one orbit around the star.
Talk about the sun a little bit, the TRAPPIST-1 star, Mal. Again, I heard it described as an ultra-cool dwarf star. That doesn't sound very cozy.
It's not very cozy. In fact, if you were standing on one of the planets, your sky would not be bright like it is, even if it has an atmosphere to it on that planet. You would have probably a really darkish type of sky, I would imagine, because it's a red star. You'd see a lot of red around you. The neat thing about it is the planets themselves are so close together in orbit around that star that you could see the other planets very readily, and they'd be very large in the sky.
Well, as I said, when this came out a couple weeks back, it was, you know, astronauts were absolutely beside themselves. Let's hear a little bit from NASA scientists just how amazed they are by this discovery of this TRAPPIST-1 solar system with these possibly, you know, habitable, if I can say that, planets. We're going to hear first from Sean Carey and then Nicole Lewis.
The big news is that around a very nearby
cold, small star, we found seven rocky, Earth-sized planets, all of which could potentially have liquid water.
For me, it's mind-blowing. The first time I saw what the system had in it, I just was like, you gotta be kidding me. And then I looked at the data myself, I'm like, yep, yeah, there they all are. It's just, I would have never predicted this. It's beyond, you know, anything I could have ever dreamt of.
Again, those are scientists Sean Carey and Nicole Luce talking about the discovery of the TRAPPIST-1 solar system and its seven rocky planets, three of which could be habitable. And she used the word mind-blowing. What word did you use, John Gene Forty, when you first read about this?
Well, it's extraordinary because, as Mal said, we found a solar system that has all terrestrial or Earth-like planets.
Not gas giants.
Exactly. And it's typical in the planets in the 3,594 extrasolar planets that we've detected to date. It's the first time that we've found a system completely with rocky Earth-like planets. Now, that doesn't mean they're like the Earth. It simply means that they're about the same size, roughly the same mass, and we think they're rocky. So that's as far as we can go. But the sizes and the habitable zone about this star, three of them are in that zone where liquid water could exist. Doesn't mean there's life. It doesn't mean that there's cities. It doesn't mean that there's intelligence there. It means that the physical conditions permit liquid water to exist on the surface without relying on the atmosphere to create some weird special habitable conditions. So that's what this means. And the fact that, you know, they go around the sun very, very rapidly, but many of the planets around stars that we've now found to have planets orbit in a short period of time. There are several stars that I study that have planets going around them in a day and a half as well, or 3 days. So orbiting close in is not too extraordinary. But in this case, the closest planet orbits in a day and a half, but the farthest one orbits in only 20 days. So they're really compressed really close to the star.
So if you're standing on one of them, you could see the other ones. You could sort of wave to the people on the other planets.
Well, kind of.
If there were people.
If you had a big white flag, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean, well, TRAPPIST-1, again, scientists were so excited about this. NASA gave TRAPPIST-1 its own website, and there's all these cool pictures on there. And, you know, artists had some fun.
Oh, they had a great time
doing renditions of this, and, you know, travel posters fly to TRAPPIST-1F or whatever it was.
No, it's only 39.5 light years away.
And one of the pictures, Mal, showed a sort of perpetual red twilight. I guess that's because the sun, TRAPPIST-1, is
sure.
Is this cool dwarf.
Yeah, it's very cool.
It didn't look very appealing, I have to say.
You wouldn't. It might be a nice place to visit, but I'm not sure you'd want to live there. But ultimately, we want to find out if there is anything living there, or is it capable of having life up there. The key, of course, is we're always looking for water, and liquid water is what we want. We don't want ice, meaning it's too far away to melt, or too close to the star where it would just boil away. And in this case, many of them are in this safe little zone. What I found interesting was the connection between where it was found and the fact that we're looking for liquid water. The star TRAPPIST-1 is actually located in the constellation of Aquarius, which is the water bearer.
Yes.
And I said, of course there's going to be something there.
So. Oh, come on, Mal.
Well, did I stretch that too far, John?
Astronomy and astrology?
No. Thanks, Mal.
That's going too far.
Well, and John, so you talked about these are rocky planets, not gas planets, and so that's always enticing because, you know, again, that's more Earth-like. How do we know they're rocky planets and not gas planets?
Well, that's a really good question. And the way these planets were found was an important, and I've been trying to talk about transiting exoplanets for a long time. And transiting exoplanet is simply a planet that orbits a star, and the star and the planet and Earth are in the same plane. That is, the planet appears to trot across the disk of its parent star as seen from Earth. If that happens, we can determine the size of the star, and we can look at the amount of light that's blocked by the planet. We can calculate the ratio of the size of the planet to the size of the star, and then get the diameter or the radius of the planet. So we know how big the planet is, and they're determining how another method used to detect planets orbiting stars is the gravitational influence of that planet on its star. That helps us determine a minimum mass for the planet. So if you have the planet's mass and you have its size, you can calculate its density. So if its density is greater than 1 gram per cubic centimeter, which is the density of water, you know that it's a rocky planet. If its density is less than one, like Saturn's is a little less than one, then you know it's most likely a gas giant planet. So the other thing about the transit method, this is the big thing that not too many people are talking about. So now we know that there are these Earth-sized planets, three of them orbiting in the habitable zone, could have water on it. Now, using the transit method, when the planet transits across the disk of the star, we can determine, A, if the planet has an atmosphere, and B, if it does, what the component gases are. So if there's oxygen, methane, ozone, carbon dioxide, these kind of gases, not simply oxygen, but a combination of them, that's a good indicator of life. Now, no one has seen that, but they are sure looking now.
Again, the exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Our Sky Guys are here today in the exchange catching up on some of the latest news in the world of astronomy, including huge news a couple weeks ago, the TRAPPIST-1 solar system and its potential for three Earth-like planets. Let's get your questions and comments in at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, John, I'm glad you mentioned atmosphere because, Mal, that's key, right? If there's no atmosphere, then whatever might be living on this planet would just get burnt up in the, you know, from the ravages of space, so to speak.
Exactly. And early on, when the TRAPPIST system was first discovered, they did not discover all seven planets at the same time. They had to use some backup stuff. The prime one they used was an infrared telescope called Spitzer, which is a space telescope. Looking at things at the infrared, it's going to pick out details that you can't see with just visible light. So it's a little bit beyond the red side of the spectrum. And that's how they determined that there were actually seven. And, of course, that got them really excited. So imagine if, as John was saying, that you look at it in infrared, it's going to be very valuable. And later on, after next year, when the James Webb telescope, space telescope, is launched, if everything goes well, they're probably going to use that to look at these planets as well and get even more detail of the atmospheres, if any, on these planets. And they can pick out all the elements that are there. And especially they're looking for things, signs of life would be things like methane especially, and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And then from there we can speculate what may be there. And for something that's only 40 light years away, that's relatively close.
Now I have to ask you, 40 light years away, can you quickly, you or John, tell me how many miles that is?
Well, it's 6 trillion times 40.
Right.
So, right, if you multiply 40.
240,000 with a 2,400,000.
No, it's
I'm losing my zeros.
So six trillion miles per.
A trillion. Right.
6 trillion miles per light year. That's 240
trillion miles. That's right.
Wow.
So that's considered a nearby star. But there's a lot of interesting facts about this star. It's close, relatively speaking, right? Okay.
I don't know. Bumpty-bump trillion miles doesn't sound very close.
You're not going to drive there, okay? But listen, the star is only 500 million years old. So it is a young system. Think about that. Half a billion, 500 million years. That's it. It's a very young star compared to the 5 billion that the sun and its planets are.
Let's go to our listeners, gentlemen. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Let's get your questions in for our Sky Guys today in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Chris is calling in from Nashua. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Thanks for taking the call. So I love this topic, and I have just a couple of questions. So the first one is, I understand that soon there's going to be some sort of a telescope that's going to allow more advanced analysis of atmospheric composition, and I'd love to get confirmation or details or whatever that's going to be. The second thing is, I'd love to hear from your Sky Guys, what's their best guess as to whether each of these three planets is habitable, not just potentially, we've established that, but, you know, what's their best guess? And maybe they could even describe each of the three, like, you know, number one is rocky, and number two is, you know, hot, and number three is, you know, whatever, from what we can tell so far.
Wow. Okay, Chris, great questions. And Chris, since you're so interested, go to our website, nhpr.org. We've got a link there to TRAPPIST-1 information, including some really fun pictures and videos and so forth. So, Mal, the telescope question first, you were starting to go there. So are there telescopes coming that can give us more information on the atmospheric composition?
It sounds to me like what he's talking about is the James Webb telescope.
Which is coming in 2018.
This is the advanced version of a Hubble, but it's very different from the Hubble, too. The Hubble was designed to be in a nearby orbit around the Earth so that it could constantly be upgraded, make visits to it, change out and update the equipment and so on. The James Webb telescope is, first of all, way behind schedule. It should have been up there by now. But the current launch window is October of next year, 2018. It was originally supposed to be 2014. But it has a big, large mirror on it that is about seven times larger than the mirror on the Hubble Space Telescope. But it's going to be strictly looking at things in the infrared wavelengths and trying to pick up those details. And I think that's probably what he's thinking about.
So, John, I'm going to give you the harder question caller asks. And that is, and I love it, best guess as to whether these three are habitable.
Well, first of all, we believe the seven are rocky. But other than that, we know nothing about them. We know their diameters. We know their distance to their sun, TRAPPIST-1. But that's all we know. So we don't know climate. We don't know if it has an atmosphere. Let's face it. If none of the planets have atmospheres, there's going to be no liquid water at the surface. Because in order to have liquid water on a planet's surface, you must have atmospheric pressure to keep that liquid a liquid instead of just evaporating into the atmosphere.
Sure, as we said earlier, right?
So if without an atmosphere, you can't have liquid water. So right now, I can promise you that there are observatories and scientists and studies looking specifically to determine atmospheric content of these planets to see if they can detect gases that would say, yes, there's definitely water on that planet, or there might be life. Although at an age of only 500 million years, I would say that that's pretty unlikely. So I don't really know. We don't really know much about the planet's personalities, right? Would it be a nice place to visit? We don't know that because it is 40 light years away.
We have to answer the atmosphere question first, then.
That's the big one.
And people are working on that right now. So maybe the next time we get together, we'll know a little bit more about that, given the huge effort that both of you have described, you know, to seek out this information.
Yes.
You both mentioned also that this is a very, 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 very long ways away, although John was saying it's not that far away. I did want to ask you both about what we're learning about the impact of long-term residency in space on human bodies. And there's been a lot out before, people on the International Space Station and so forth, but now we're getting some more data on that through the study of two astronaut twins, Mark and Scott Kelly. What are we finding out, John?
Well, we do know that there are some issues with long-term habitation of space. The shape of the eyeball changes in
really?
Low gravity.
Wow.
So that makes it, that changes your vision. So they were quipping on one of the sources that we were looking at that it makes it hard for the astronauts to read fine print. Well, that can be important when you're trying to read the manual for the ejection seat, you know?
Right.
So the shape of the eyeball due to low gravity, because in orbit around the Earth, even though there is gravity in space, let's make sure that the listeners understand that there's gravity in space, right? We know that there's gravity in space because Earth's gravity is what holds the moon in orbit around it, right? So there's gravity in space, but when you're orbiting in a spacecraft around the Earth, you feel no gravity because you're in a constant state of free fall. So that is the issue on the human body. The shape of the brain changes because of lack of Earth gravity. We don't know the long, long-term effects of that. So there are some issues with a human body being away from the gravity of the Earth, and that is, those are going to have to be dealt with. In my humble opinion, long-term space travel to the planets or beyond is going to have to include a source of gravity. And that can be achieved by a rotating spacecraft. And none of the engineers at NASA want to hear that. But if you're going to send humans to space, unless you have a warp drive, which is not on the horizon, that then you're going to have to make it so that it isn't a health hazard to spend a year or two in space.
Yeah, it's interesting. And what you say about the brain, I read something about the brain has fluid in it, and so the lack of
exactly.
gravity makes some changes there. I had not read about the eyeball. That's very interesting. Mal, go ahead, jump in.
Yeah, I just want to back up a little bit. If you, we are as humans, we are designed to be here on Earth, obviously. This is the way we have evolved, all right?
Basic point.
And
right.
we are built for gravity. When we're walking around on the Earth, the blood flow wants to go down to our legs and our feet because that's what gravity is doing. It's pulling the blood supply down below. So we're fighting that all the time. That's why we have a heart that pumps that blood up into our heads and our brains and helps us to think. Take away the gravity and the blood just goes wherever it wants to, and it collects up into the brain and in the head. And sometimes you even gain there was a story several years ago of an astronaut who had a little back problem, went up into space, and the lack of gravity stretched his spine enough
yeah.
so that he came back to Earth healed.
Taller, too.
Taller.
Yeah, that actually makes sense because you have
it's
compression
not compressed.
Of the discs.
Right.
Yeah.
But I had not thought about the blood flow.
Yeah.
That's
right.
A little bit creepy, Mal.
Well... We could save that for Halloween some year, maybe.
Right.
But it's true. This is what we have to cope with. How do you overcome that and keep the astronauts safe?
Well, coming up, we're going to revisit a familiar topic. Should Pluto be reclassified as a planet this week? That's the debate at a big astronomy conference. So we'll talk about that and take more of your calls. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, our sky guys are here, and we're catching up on some major developments in astronomy, including huge excitement over the TRAPPIST-1 solar system and its potential for three habitable Earth-like planets. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And John Gianforte, Mal Cameron, here's an email from Kyle who says, so here's the thing, if we were ever to find a planet we could live on, my prediction is only people of importance would go live there, possibly the rich. The poor would be left on Earth. It would probably be like the Matt Damon movie where the rich live in space and the poor are left on Earth. I think he means the movie, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Elysian? Am I pronouncing that right? Anyway, I do wonder about this. We do hear about private companies sending folks up into space. The company SpaceX, Mal, has plans to take two individuals. We don't know who they are, but they plunked down a lot of money and they're going to go on a big trip.
Yeah, the concept that they said was that Elon Musk, who owns SpaceX, said that he has two people, he did not name them, who apparently have made a very hefty deposit on doing this. And by the end of next year, he wants to have his Dragon 2 capsule and his extra heavy lift rocket ready to send that rocket to the moon, go around the moon a few times, and then come back to Earth. But the original plan was just to do it empty. But now these two people say, we want to go. We'll pay you whatever it is to go, and we don't want to. We just want to ride on that rocket and be the first ones to go back to the moon since the Apollo program.
So the rocket is not right now, or at least until
the
now.
The rocket is not ready to fly.
And neither is the capsule.
The capsule is not ready to fly.
Yeah, neither one of them have been tested. They're still in development. So this is not going to happen.
Even though these individuals probably plunked down a whole bunch of money, a sizable deposit.
They're trying to make it happen, though.
They're trying, but think about it. We haven't been to the moon in 45 years. This is a company that's never been to the moon. Right, and they're doing great work. They're absolutely like there's no denying it. They're changing the history and they're changing the future of space travel. And I compliment them.
This is SpaceX again, owned by Elon Musk.
SpaceX,
yeah,
that's right. But that's less than 2 years to get a space capsule that's going to house the astronauts for a week, 3 days there, 3 days back, and a heavy launch vehicle that's going to get them off the ground that have not been tested, and is still in development. So that's a huge risk. And they probably will do it, but it won't be in 2018. That's just my take on it, because there's so much testing that has to be involved. And if you go to their website and you look at the capsule, it's this really sleek looking, like a really fancy car dashboard, like you'd see in an expensive sci-fi movie. And it looks really sexy. The spacecraft is white, but none of it's been built, none of it's been tested. So it's still being developed.
I do wonder, you know, Kyle talks about the space haves and have nots, and thank you for the email, Kyle. I do wonder who these folks are that would plunk down a deposit, a big deposit, according to the news release, on something, John, that's not tested and not ready and,
well,
you know.
Let's say it's not 2018. Let's say it's 2020. Okay, what's a couple more years on something that's now been tested and is now sanctioned to be safe?
Right? Well, here's another question that I had when I saw the news release, and I'll ask you, Mal. Why pay all that money to just fly around the moon? I mean, if I were going to go all that way, I would at least want my boots to touch down. I mean, I don't know. It seems rather unsatisfying.
They want to take their own selfie with the Earthrise in the background. I don't know. But this is like the Apollo 8 that went up in 1968. They had jumped ahead with that flight because of all the trauma that was going on in the world at the time, and decided at the last minute that they would put a crew on board and actually send a crew to the moon and back when they were really going to do an Earth orbital thing and delay it. But they said, we think we're ready. What SpaceX is going to do is they have to, first of all, develop that, what they call the Falcon Heavy. Their boosters are called Falcons. They've done a very good job of determining how to bring that booster back to Earth. And they've been able to re-land it and reuse it.
Yeah, so you save a lot of money that way.
Right.
Instead of just
Falcon Heavy,
letting it blow up.
Think of roughly three of those rockets strapped side by side with about 27 engines on the bottom to give about 5 million pounds of thrust, I think it is, to get this off the ground. And then you have to get this Dragon 2 capsule, which is ultimately designed to hold as many as 7 people. But they'll have 2. They'll have it all to themselves.
Well,
if they'll
have. You need astronauts, though, right? I mean, these two un-astronaut people can't.
Yeah,
go up on
it
their
sounds
own,
like
right? They need a pilot.
They're just going to go along for the ride. I doubt they'll.
Well,
have
they were
going
to do it
to
without anybody
them.
Crewing it. It'd be robotic.
Right. Oh,
right? Because,
I see.
And I'm not sure that they're actually going to orbit several times. I just thought they were going to use the moon's gravity to slingshot the spacecraft back, which would mean you could just sit there in a recliner. Right, for all practical purposes, and just enjoy the ride if it was controlled robotically and from Earth. That could be done.
Like a self-driving car?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll set that aside for the moment and go back to our listeners. Kyle, thank you for that email. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Paul's calling in from Berlin. Hi, Paul. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello there. How are you?
Morning. Good.
I have a question regarding to that TRAPPIST-1 system.
Yeah.
I heard from one of your guests that he said about this particular star that is relatively young, and it's like 40 light years away. I love the subject of astronomy, but I understand that from a new star that is born, it would be very bright, and the star would be rather hot than cool, because I read in some magazine that this TRAPPIST-1 star is a cool star.
Yeah.
And I don't see how there could be possibly any life on any planets when the star gets to the phase of becoming a red star or an orange.
You know, Paul, thank you for listening so closely, and it's a great question. Mm-hmm. And John, it is a good question. I mean, usually we think of cool stars as being very old.
It's an excellent question, and you're really listening carefully. So when stars form from interstellar clouds of dust and gas, they start to collapse under their own gravity. And stars form from these interstellar clouds in many different masses. The most important thing about a star when it's forming is how much stuff is contained in its volume. What's its mass? The initial mass of a star at its birth, when it first turns on, says everything about the star's future. This star is a normal star. It's what we call a main sequence star. A main sequence star is what 90% of the stars in the sky are. They fuse hydrogen into helium in their core and produce energy. This star, when it formed, just happened to have 0.08 times the mass of the sun, which is very lightweight for a star, very low mass. So when it formed as a cool star with a surface temperature of only about 4,150 degrees.
Oh, okay.
Compared
so that's,
to 10,000 for the sun. So a star doesn't necessarily start out blazing hot and then cool. This started out a low mass star, low temperature, small, not much mass, low temperature. So it's classified as a red dwarf.
Oh, that's interesting. And I'm with Paul. I thought that stars started out, you know, bright and hot. And then when they got older, they turned into, you know, cool dwarfs or red dwarfs or whatever you want to call it. But that's not the case. They're all born in a particular way.
And they're born in a similar way, but at different masses.
With different characteristics. That's what I meant to
sure,
say.
Sure. Yeah. So let's say that instead of, one-tenth the mass of the sun, let's say a star formed that had 10 times the mass of the sun. That mass would cause that star to contract much quicker because its gravity is stronger, and it would burn. Its surface temperature would be much, much higher, more like 10,000 degrees or even 20,000 degrees, as opposed to, 4,000 degrees as TRAPPIST-1 is.
So, John, though, is it the case when our sun gets older, won't it turn into a cool star or a dwarf or something like that? I mean, as it ages?
Yes. Normal stars that live 90% of their life on this main sequence where they fuse hydrogen to helium, they act pretty much normal throughout that period. But once they exhaust their fusible hydrogen in their core, all stars, low mass or high mass, begin to change. They do weird things. They grow into red giants. They puff off their outer layers as a planetary nebula. And then if you're a low mass star like TRAPPIST-1 or the sun, you eventually end up as a white dwarf.
Okay.
Or if it's a massive star, you end up as a supernova explosion, a neutron star, or a black hole.
Okay. Well, I hope ours doesn't go supernova on us.
It will. It will never go supernova.
Thank you so much for the question, Paul. You can join us too at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So, guys, we've been talking a lot about TRAPPIST-1, this solar system, and the three possibly Earth-like planets in this system. Mal, let's get a little closer to home. We need to talk about the demoted planet Pluto in our own solar system, demoted about a decade ago. The 48th Lunar and Planetary Science Conference is ongoing this week, and some people there are excited to once again try to promote Pluto. So, my goodness, this doesn't seem to go away, Mal.
Well, it doesn't. The one who's doing the main promoting is the gentleman who was in charge of the New Horizons mission that just passed Pluto last year.
I see.
And, gosh, his name eluded. Do you remember?
Alan Stern.
Alan Stern. Yeah. Yes, that's right. And he's an interesting guy. Several years ago, I remember in 2006, the International Astronomical Union had its meeting overseas, and that's where they defined planet. And basically, the definition that exists says that in order to be a quote-unquote planet, it has to be an object that's orbiting the sun without being the moon of another planet. It has to be large enough so that its own gravity has pulled it together into a sphere. And the third most important thing was that it has to be in an orbit that has cleared its way for that object to be.
Go ahead, Mal. Say it.
Go ahead.
Use the word.
What?
It has cleared its...
Its path?
Its neighborhood.
Its neighborhood. That's
okay,
right.
So that's the rub. What is a neighborhood in the outer solar system?
Yeah.
Tell me what that
sounds
is.
Sounds like Mr. Rogers to me. I don't know.
So Pluto met two of those, but not the third one.
Right.
So it got demoted 10 years ago. So
Pluto's in the what's called the Kuiper Belt.
Right.
This other object around it.
So who wants to promote Pluto again?
Mr. Stern does.
So here's the thing. He's the principal investigator for New Horizons. And all you have to do is go to the New Horizons website and look at the unbelievable images that spacecraft took as it flew by really fast through the Pluto system. And don't forget, Pluto has five moons. Mm-hmm. So if anything justifies it being a planet, maybe that does. But it's such an interesting place that has made Pluto, has elevated Pluto to be back on the agenda.
So, John, Pluto back on the agenda. How so?
Only it's on the agenda of a very few individuals. Certainly, all the elementary school kids want Pluto to be a planet again.
I don't know. Today's elementary school kids might have forgotten about
Pluto.
Oh,
no. No, no.
Really?
No, no.
That's a big question.
I'm thinking the middle schoolers and the high schoolers might
Whenever
be promoting
Pluto. Whenever I go into a kindergarten, first grade, second grade classroom, they still want to know about Pluto.
Oh.
So it's maybe their parents who have that longing to resurrect Pluto as a planet. I'm
right.
Not sure.
Well, we all have the puzzles that little kids do on the floor, and
yeah.
I've got a couple of those. And
cups, dishes, right?
So mobiles.
Yeah. I don't think this is very serious. It's not being taken very seriously by the astronomical community. This group meeting in Woodlands, Texas, is taking it seriously. But they just came off a hugely successful mission to Pluto that just revolutionized our view and our concept of what Pluto is. It's a fascinating world.
Why does this matter, Mal, in the bigger scheme of things? I mean, it's kind of fun to talk about and...
Well, yeah. I think that over the years that I've come to the conclusion, I was disappointed when they demoted Pluto because, after all, it was discovered by an American, right, back in 1930.
Tombaugh?
Clyde Tombaugh.
Clyde Tombaugh.
And he was just a worker at a telescope that discovered this stuff, but he did the process of checking sky charts and comparing different dates with same sky charts and determining which object was moving in this background of stars, and that became Pluto. But it's been down as the ninth planet for the longest time. but then it got demoted because we've discovered more about the solar system, more about the Kuiper Belt and all these other objects
yeah,
we didn't know were there. So we're constantly adjusting, and I think that should be happening. We can't just say, this is cast in stone, now Pluto's going to be a planet forever. It's a planet of sorts. It's a dwarf planet.
So that's why it matters. It reflects ongoing knowledge, expanding knowledge, ongoing understandings, and we're not just, you know, staying in place.
Right. And I think that's what Dr. Stern wants to do, is to look at it again and redo it. But I think he's going a little too far, because ultimately he has this very wordy type of a new definition that he wants.
And I'm glad you didn't read it, because
I'm
it's
not
very
going to read
wordy.
It. But the bottom line is that he's saying that any round object in space that is smaller than a star could be a planet.
Oh, come on, Alan.
And that means, now, and that includes...
the moon.
The moon.
Come on.
Right.
Listen,
well,
the moon is just happy and fine with being... the moon. Why mess with that?
Did anybody ask the moon if it wants to, how do you feel about being, you know, a planet?
Well, I kind of like the idea,
sure.
Mal. You know, I'm going to start a...
Although, in fairness to this guy, we've talked about on this show before about Europa, for example, one of Jupiter's moons. Mm-hmm. Okay, so clearly moonish because it's, you know,
orbiting
Jupiter. But it's got a lot of interesting stuff going on, John.
I mean,
you know, water and geysers and oceans and ice.
Well,
and so
that would be a planet, too,
that
according
planet-ish.
To Alan Stern.
And there's Enceladus. And,
orbiting Saturn. So
Saturn.
There'd be, you know, 110 planets in the solar system today if we adopted that definition. Okay.
And you have to memorize every one of them.
Yeah, put those
right.
on a puzzle.
Sure.
Real quickly, John, on this topic of 8 or 9 planets, I read that NASA is trying to find a 9th planet, but not necessarily Pluto.
Right. Yes. The Pluto killer, Mike Brown from Caltech, who is...
That's his Twitter handle, by the way.
Yes,
so.
Yes, I know. So this is the guy that discovered an object out in the Pluto's vicinity that led to Pluto's demise as a planet and introduction into the dwarf planet status. He and a colleague have announced that there is a planet that has 10 to 20 times the mass of the Earth, that takes 10,000 years to orbit the sun. It's really far out there. And they base this on mathematical models of something massive in the deep outer solar system is gravitationally perturbing or influencing the objects out by Pluto and causing them to orbit in a certain way.
All right, more in a moment. This is The Exchange.
Hello, thanks for subscribing and for listening to The Exchange podcast. I'm Andrew Perella. I'm the production manager at New Hampshire Public Radio, where The Exchange is produced. And I'm here with Christina Phillips, who's one of the producers on The Exchange. How's it going, Christina?
I'm great. Thanks for having me here.
Excellent, excellent. So I suppose you have heard about this crazy new initiative, Tripod.
Yeah. So all this month, we're asking you to tell a friend about a podcast you love. So maybe it's somebody who's never listened to podcasts before. Maybe they're a radio listener, or maybe they don't listen to the radio at all and they don't know anything about NPR, but they've got a phone and you might want to introduce them to some podcasts.
Exactly. What we're basically asking you to do is become a missionary for the pod sphere. We want you to go out and find someone you know who doesn't podcast and encourage them to podcast by recommending a podcast you think they'd love. So, Christina, what are you listening to these days?
I listen to a lot of podcasts.
Yeah.
I have so many on my phone that I don't have any music because I don't have room for music. One that I've been listening to a lot recently is Reveal, which comes from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. And basically what they do is they take a story, a lead, and they investigate it over a long period of time. They've got a team of journalists, and they go in and they report on something maybe that's related to current events or maybe not. So recently they investigated in California a medical marijuana grower who is a small farmer, and he's struggling now that big industry is coming into California, now that they've got legalized marijuana, legalized medical marijuana, and recreational marijuana. So they investigated that, and that was super interesting, and I knew nothing about it. So, yeah, it's a great, great podcast.
Sounds like it's right up the alley of Exchange listeners. So anyone who's a fan of the Exchange would enjoy something like Reveal, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think it's really great storytelling as well. And you hear from some experts that we've probably had on the show in the past. Who knows? Because we have so many great guests. So, yeah.
So you heard it here, folks. If you're digging podcasts, recommend the Exchange. Recommend Reveal to a friend or loved one. And you can tell us what you're listening to by, what is it?
And so you want to use the hashtag TryPod. That's TryPod. You see what we did there? Yeah. So let us know what you've recommended, and we'll be recommending too.
All right. Keep listening.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, our Sky Guys are back with the latest developments from the world of space science, including the ever-expanding possibility of Earth-like planets in other nearby solar systems. Also, we've been looking at whether poor old Pluto should be re-promoted to planet status within our own system. Join us with your questions, comments, suggestions, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And Mal Cameron, John Gene Forty, give us a little preview for something really cool this summer. John, August is a ways away, but you Sky Guys are already preparing for something big. What is it?
Well, on the 21st of August, in midday, let's say, at least on the eastern part of the west, east of the Mississippi, there will be a total solar eclipse. And this eclipse is being billed as the Great American Eclipse. It's being billed that way because the path of totality, the path you have to be on to experience the shadow of the moon as it crosses the sun, extends from the northwest to the southeast. And it's about approximately, it varies, but it's approximately 100 miles wide, the swath across the country, as the moon's shadow touches on the northwest and moves 1,000 miles an hour toward the southeast. People on the eclipse path, on the center line, will experience darkness in the morning if you're on the West Coast, or the early afternoon if you're east of the Mississippi.
So give us a couple of the big states that are preparing to really get a good view of this.
Well, Wyoming, Missouri, Nebraska, Tennessee, Kentucky, South Carolina, Oregon.
You didn't say New Hampshire.
No. New Hampshire will see about 60%, depending on where in the state you are, 60% of the sun's surface will be obscured by the moon. So it will be a partial solar eclipse.
For us.
Which is dangerous. Because if you know there's going to be an eclipse, chances are you're going to be out there during the eclipse looking at the sun, which is a no-no. During the total phase of an eclipse, you can actually watch the eclipse without eye protection because the sun is completely covered by the moon, so it's safe. But this eclipse is lasting a very, very short time. But if you're not on the eclipse path where the eclipse will be total, you can never look at the sun without proper eye protection. Now, that's easier than it might sound because you can buy these eclipse glasses that are approved and reduce 99.9% of the sun's ultraviolet and infrared rays, which is what damages your eye. It's not the brightness, it's the infrared and ultraviolet that causes damage to your eye. So anybody that's not on the eclipse path and it's not totality, you can't look at the sun. You've got to wear eye protection. So if you're going to stay in New Hampshire, you must have these solar eclipse glasses or make a pinhole camera to see the eclipse.
I remember a pinhole camera a long time ago. You just called up a childhood memory for me, John. Was
they
another
still
partial
work.
Eclipse? Because I do remember standing out there with like some cardboard thing. And
1983, okay. 1994. 1994, there were two eclipses, but one, I think, was a partial from New Hampshire. 1983 was a partial from here.
Actually, in 94, there was an annular eclipse Concord.
It was annular, yes.
Okay. Right. And Mal, I understand you've already got your tickets. South Carolina, you're going.
You better believe it. Yes.
So hotels filling up if you want to see it?
I looked at the path and decided I wanted to find a place that was somewhat easy to drive to without having to spend a lot of money. So I'm going to be in Columbia, South Carolina on that day. And there's a science center there, which is having events all day that I bought tickets for as well. So we'll make it a big deal. And it's going to go right overhead there. To talk about the path, if you think about a map of the United States and look at, you know, the left coast, as we call it, the entry point is going to be roughly around northern Oregon, right near the Washington state line. And it's going to go diagonally down across the country through, like John said, the Missouri and Tennessee, Kentucky, and that area, all the way down and exit just at the base of South Carolina out by the Georgia line. So I think of Miss America's sash going down
American eclipse.
Exactly.
Well,
it's going to be a lot of fun. In fact, in South Carolina, they said the totality time will be just over 2.5 minutes that the sun will be blocked by the moon.
So okay. It's not a long time. We've got a website that shows you the path. If you decide you want to see a total solar eclipse, which I would wholeheartedly recommend, make your travel plans now because hotels are being booked on the center line.
What is that website, John, that shows you the path?
I sent it to the...
Okay.
It should be up on our website.
At NHPR.org. It is on our website, so people can look there if you are, like Mal, making travel plans already. So we'll probably talk before that eclipse this summer, so I'm going to set that aside for now. Often on this program, guys, we talk a lot about what NASA's doing, what SpaceX is doing, what Americans are doing, but it's worth mentioning that it isn't just Americans and NASA and SpaceX who are making inroads into space. Other countries, the Europeans, the Chinese, the Russians, India recently put a lot more stuff into space. Now, what is India putting up there? Mal, do you want to jump in on that?
Well, their big claim recently in February and last month, on February 15th, they actually launched the greatest number of satellites ever put into orbit at the same time. The previous record had been like 37 satellites. Now, obviously, these are small deals, but they launched 104 satellites in one launch. And they came from all over, many of them from the United States, and a good bulk of them were Earth studies that they were doing. The latest trend in some of these satellites are very small, maybe oversized Rubik cube type things, and they call them CubeSats. And they have cameras in them and small little things, so all these little tiny things are up there orbiting from that. I want to say one thing about India that when I was looking through some research for this program, I discovered that they have a big role for women in their space program. After having heard about Hidden Figures, the movie, and what we went through with John Glenn's flight and all the flights since.
And the three African-American women who played a huge role in that flight.
India places a big role on scientifically inclined women. And in planning these space flights, and if you just go online to India Space Program or something, you should find this link that talks about some of the women scientists who are working on their programs. A couple of years ago, they actually sent a Mars orbiter mission out, which was the first time they ventured to Mars. It was very successful.
The spacecraft is still working right now.
Yeah, and I like the Mars Orbiter Mission, or MOM.
MOM, I like that.
Is the name of the mission. So there's probably a lot more to come out of India. They have a very aggressive program over there.
So how does it work, John? India, as Mal told us, sent up 140-some-odd satellites.
104.
But those aren't all Indian satellites. Those are American. Maybe some are commercial, some are research. I mean, how does that work? Does one country or company say, hey, gang, I'm going to be doing a big launch, in 6 months from now. If you want your climate observer or your communications assister, come on over, give it to us, and we'll shoot it up for you. That's how it works?
There's a big collaboration between the United States and India on a number of different fronts. So we collaborate on missions. Certainly the MOM mission, we collaborated with them. They sent probes to the moon as well. So orbiting the moon. So they have a very successful and active and vigorous space program. So through that collaboration, I think 94 of those 104 were from the United States. The other ones were from India and a couple of other countries. But as Mal said, these things are called CubeSats or nanosatellites. They're not these big communication satellites like the Hubble Space Telescope or anything that size. They're really small. They're like cell phone size or maybe just a little bit bigger than that.
So they're quite small.
But they can pack a lot of electronics, solar panels, batteries, cameras, radios, data collection sensors that sense magnetic fields, solar radiation, and even cameras to take pictures of the Earth and send them back.
So if the bulk of those satellites or those things that the Indians put up were from the United States, why don't we just put our own stuff up?
Well, I think it was
why do we have to send it all the way to India?
Well, I think it was a collaborative effort, and they wanted to break the record, and this helped them do that, right? The previous record was 37, held by Russia. That was a couple of years ago. And I don't know, it's just something that maybe they wanted to do. They were sending a spaceship up anyway, and we had a lot of CubeSats on the shelf, wanted to, you know, so I think it was something like that.
Hitched a ride on the bus, so to speak. Well, yeah, speaking of all the stuff that's up there, I read just recently, guys, that Japan made news with a plan to clean up space junk. Now, we won't judge whether what India put up was junk or not, but what is space junk, Mal?
It's a satellite material, remnants of rockets that have put those satellites into space at various distances from the Earth that are orbiting around. If you've seen the movie Gravity, even though they got some of that wrong.
John's hanging his head.
Sorry, John.
Was that movie horribly inaccurate?
We don't have time to get into that.
I didn't see it.
But the idea was that gravity was, the gravity was the premise of the opening part of the movie was space junk that started colliding with each other and spreading around and destroying spacecraft in the process.
Well, it's nuts,
but
bolts,
there's
gloves,
a lot of
tools,
stuff there.
Stuff
sure.
That's fallen off satellites.
Right. Okay, so space junk is a problem.
It is.
So what was
what
the Japanese
Japan
plan
was
to
trying to do is
they wanted
to try a method of cleaning up some of this space junk as they were in orbit or approaching orbit by using this really long whip-like tether that was supposed to go out, and I don't know what was on the end of the tether, but maybe netting or something that was supposed to pick up these satellites to see if this is a way like a scoop or something.
Like a fishing net.
Yeah. To pick up some of this junk and just bring it back to Earth by burning up in the atmosphere. And getting rid of it and kind of clearing the neighborhood, I guess, you know, is what I'm thinking about.
But hey, that was good, Mal.
As they do with Pluto. But unfortunately, the tether did not deploy. It was attached to a supply ship that went to the ISS. They got the supplies there, but the tether experiment did not work.
Well, that's partly what space exploration is all about. Some
exactly.
stuff works and some stuff
exactly.
doesn't,
that's
but
right.
they keep trying.
They'll know what not to do next time.
Sure. All right. Well, gentlemen, speaking of next time we'll have a lot to talk about, including that lunar eclipse and some more information about the TRAPPIST-1 solar system, because I'm guessing there'll be more information coming out. For now, though, we'll wrap it up. Thank you so much for being here. I really, really appreciate it. And John Gianforte, it's always fun to talk to you.
Great to be here, Laura. Thank you for asking.
John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. And Mal Cameron, always fun. Thanks so much.
Great to be here. Have a wonder-filled day.
Mal Cameron, former astronomy and space educator with the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.